welcome to another episode of Soundstage Access, a podcast that brings you in depth to discuss many of the complex, beautiful, and creative sides of filmmaking. I'm your host, Brando Benetton, and my guest this week is Eve Stewart. A four-time Oscar-nominated production designer whose credits include a wide range of prestige period films, as well as this year's brand new movies, Kraven the Hunter and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. In today's conversation, the 63-year-old and I discuss anecdotes from set and her experience designing Oscar-winning films like Les Miserables, The King's Speech, and my favorite film of 2017, Gore Verbinski's gothic thriller A Cure for Wellness. The story of a Wall Street stockbroker who travels to a remote location in the Swiss Alps to retrieve his company's CEO from a mysterious wellness center. In addition to Eve describing what it was like to handle one of the biggest sets of A Cure for Wellness completely burning down in a freak accident, she also reveals what she makes of the critical and commercial disaster of 2019's Cats, and what it was like to design the world of that film. All of this, and much more. Children have got to be fed, and you're lucky. If you enjoy Soundstage Access, you might want to hit that subscribe button to find all previous episodes. We'd love to ask you to support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. But now, without further ado, let's go to our conversation. Eve, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I'm extremely excited. I figure we could take things back and talk about your beginnings in theater. I mean, I'm curious how this such a creative environment that is kind of based on economy, you know, because you don't have a lot of resources. How did that turn out to be the perfect training ground for when you eventually started working in films?
Well, I think it started even before that. As a kid, I was growing up in a single parent family in the 60s in the middle of East End of London. And it was tough. It was really tough. And so I would make my brothers and sisters like create environments out of cardboard boxes. And we would make all these little houses about how we thought life should be. And I just constantly invented stories and stuff like that. And it seemed a natural progression. So I was very good at painting and I thought I wanted to be a fine artist, but apparently I was too noisy and too frenetic and couldn't like sit still long enough to do that contemplation of a colour for 3 days. So I gradually got moved to department until some clever person in London just went, oh, you should do theatre design. Because you can then do everything. You can control your entire world. You can build worlds and fill them up. And I was very lucky then to be accepted onto an amazing course in Central St Martins, as it was then, which is quite a famous London art school. And yeah, it was really amazing. You'd spend weeks designing operas and little tiny models and create your entire world and tell a story in miniature. But it was pretty tough. We had these tutors that would then just snap huge bits out and go, well, that's too expensive, and stamp them on the floor. Just go, well, what's the point of that? But it was very lucky that I won an award from that college that meant I could then start working in theatre. And in a very quick way, what happened then is I worked with a number of good directors and eventually ended up working with Mike Lee, doing a piece of theatre for him in Hampstead in London. We got on really well, and he just then asked me to work on one of his films. So it was a really, really meteoric rise into film, because he said, do you want to be an art director on a film? I didn't even know what that was. I was like, yeah, if it's easier than being a theatre designer where you get actually no money at all. My life in theatre was the best thing I could have ever done, because I'm probably so quick to understand a script and the minimum way that you can tell it visually. So if you're on a stage, you've got to tell a whole passing of an epoch with one flattage,
or you've got one prop to kind of display how the wealth, the character, the history of the family. It makes you very kind of understanding and of your way to distill telling a story. And I think that's where it's worked. And especially later now trying to do these kind of superhero things, in that it's very quick that you have to kind of reveal a huge new character, their entire world and where they live and everything. And to do that, you've got to have a really quick way of doing shorthand. So I think it also was a way of understanding that you can really cheat with architecture, in that I often make layers of things, scenery, where you're looking through a door to another door to another door. And it's giving an impression that something is huge and palatial, where in fact it's just six flats with some holes in them.
I figured we could take a step back and talk about actually receiving a screenplay, because I know you're an avid illustrator. So how does your own approach to conceptual designs and research usually allow you to find a way into a story?
Well, I think, as you said, that my theatre training has really, really helped, because in a theatre play script, you have to actually visualise every single word, because you cannot illustrate it in a black room with two lights and someone else, you know, one teapot. So you've got to really distill down the essence of what each scene is trying to say. And I think that's a rare skill that I've taken forward. And the directors that I work with always say it's unusual that, A, I can draw brilliant. You know, I'm not brilliant, but I'm really, really good at drawing what someone's telling me to draw or what idea I want to get across. And in designers, that's quite rare, apparently. I thought all designers could draw, but apparently it's not. And what happened was, coupled with the theatre discipline of learning how to break down a script and visualise each scene with the minimum of visuals, has really helped. Thereafter, of course, you then learn to look at history. You know, I'll look at every single book on the planet. Though years ago, you didn't have Google, so you'd have to go to every library in London and look at, have a huge collection of books. So yeah, I'm an avid researcher. And actually, I'm luckier that from school and whatever, I have that kind of brain that can retain kind of historical information. So I'm very good at kind of that, which has helped with directors like Tom Hooper.
And speaking of Tom Hooper, I feel like there couldn't be a better segue. The first project I wanted to ask you a little bit about is Les Miserables, of course. For a film with such epic scale, there must have been a massive difference of resources between the great locations where you shot in the UK and Paris, but also you have quite a bit of stage work. So I wonder, because each approach requires a different amount of time, schedule, resources, do you try to be relentless for a film like that, trying to make locations work first before choosing to build entire blocks inside a soundstage?
Well, yeah, because it was really amazing, because Tom, like me, wants to really understand the reality and the truth of the world that we're trying to create. So that's our first step always. And so I think I was the only one that had read the whole book, you know, the Victor Hugo book twice through, and underlined every descriptive passage about a street or a cart or whatever. So the initial idea on Les Miserables was that we would indeed follow Jean Valjean's journey through France, you know, from the shipbuilding and the prison up to Paris. So I actually did that journey for about 6-8 weeks, recorded everything, went to various places that were mentioned in the book, only to come back to London. They went, we're not going to France. It's too expensive. So that's when we had to rethink completely, turn on a sixpence and go, okay, well, we've got to build a lot because it needs to be heightened. It's a musical. That Paris that was of Victor Hugo's Les Miserables and the original musical doesn't exist because of the very reason in the musical, because it was all windy, narrow streets. And every time anyone had a revolution, they'd throw all the furniture out the windows, block the street. And so nobody could get there. So the Parisians worked out that they had to like knock all those streets down. Haussmann, the new architect of Paris, decided that you could only have these wide boulevards you see now, mainly because you could get a load of army horses down to kill everyone. There is a thing that never dies.
mean, since you are touching on those sets specifically, and we are talking about the indoor stages where you had to rebuild Paris for reasons you just explained, you had an amazing group of carpenters working with you, but you asked them to, you know, build facades without necessarily straight lines or in the traditional sense of things. And I was wondering, most of that must have been a stylistic choice, perhaps borrowing from, you know, German expressionism. But I also began wondering how much of it was trying to use forest perspective to make some of the sets look even bigger.
I think that was a consideration, the forest perspective. But ultimately, the original photographs before the old Paris was knocked down, and indeed the same can be said of London, everything subsided. They were built in appalling bits of wood and just thrown together. So everything was really crooked and wonky and kind of angular. And yes, the joy of working with those carpenters was ultimately carpenters, and any builder likes to build in straight lines because it's efficient and it's cheap. But yes, it was very interesting trying to like a squeaky, like not very tall woman trying to control people 50 foot in the air, trying to nudge a window to the left or a roof to the right. It came down to that in the end. I'd just get up on the scaffolding and draw with chalk the incredible angles that we needed to achieve, much to everyone's annoyance. Although they are a brilliant set of people, and I've worked with them many, many times, and all of them love to sing. However butch they are, stage carpenters, they all love a bit of showtime and showbiz.
I wanted to spend a generous amount of time talking about A Cure for Wellness, which was my favorite movie of 2017. I mean, because the production was based out of Germany also, I was trying to figure out, and you hadn't worked with Gore Verbinski before, I was curious to ask you how you got involved. I mean, I don't know if your agency pitched you or you had to audition.
No, I think my agency pitched me. And then also, I think he'd seen some of the more theatrical stuff I'd done, and he really enjoyed the colors. And we instantly clicked the minute we met. It was just like, he's such a visionary and he's so meticulous and exciting. I mean, we'd spend hours with him going through the script, and he'd draw these very bizarre little biro drawings that once I've kept a load of them, but they mean absolutely nothing now. They're bizarre. But when you're there, it makes such sense that, you know, even in the beginning scene where people are pressing up and down their pens, we talked about pens for a week. That's how detailed he is. So it was an amazing experience.
There is a sickness inside us, rising like the bile that leaves that bitter taste at the back of our throats. It's there in every one of you seated around the table. Only when we know what ails us can we hope to find the cure.
What do you make of that?
Clearly he's lost his mind.
Our thoughts exactly.
I wanted to kind of start off by talking about your time in Bielitz and the restoration process.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to create context for listeners, this is a beautiful complex of abandoned buildings outside of Berlin that operate as a military hospital. And you used it not only for the main courtyard, but also the main lobby inside, the thermal bath, the main dining room. Because the place had been abandoned for 50 years, is my understanding, Bojan Bazeli, the cinematographer, was saying that you spent close to, correct me if I'm wrong, but $2 million on restorations alone. And again, I'll be offering you quotes of yours for today's conversation. This is the first one for today. Quote, "In Bielitz, the colors, lights, and especially textures were so brilliantly representative of the spirit of our story, so that the incredible length of the corridors made it a no-brainer for us to use. It gave the movie a sense of history," close quote. So I don't know what kind of guidelines the owners gave you as to what you could or couldn't touch, but how did you manage the whole restoration process in general, and how did your experience evolve from the way you and Gore Verbinski, the director, thought the sanatorium was going to look like to the way it actually did?
We were pretty good at visualizing together what it needed to look like. But much of that aforementioned 2 million, I would say, went on the roof, because the thing was, there was water pouring through. So we were constantly mending huge swamps of water coming down into the corridors. So that was a really big
part of it. And I think, as I said before, just the scale of the, you don't get that kind of hugeness in the UK, particularly that kind of very, very, there's only two very long corridors in hospitals, and they're both lunatic asylums in the UK. But being very kind of parochial, quite small country, everything's built kind of little and quite Gothic arches. Whereas that was just, I mean, immense. And the minute we walked into it, it was spectacular. And as I said before, the amount of high arched windows with the light flooding in was really what drew us to it. And the particular way that we wanted to configure the corridors. So we decorated three long corridors in subtly different colours. And then the baths was my best bit. I loved that bit. There were two there, but they were full of like dead rats and things like that. So a lot of it was cleaning it out and then understanding water, etc. But the palette and the actual colour of the tiles, and we augmented it with my coloured walls and things. I would say Gore and I discussed it and settled upon three colours within kind of 20 minutes of meeting. We both felt instinctively that these were the right colours.
So it sounds like it was more about applying colour as an emotional tool and not necessarily about restoring the place the way it used to be originally.
No, it was definitely not as it used to be. It was definitely trying to kind of almost romanticize it in the way the light beams were controlled and which windows we kept very clean and which ones we put ivy over, etc. Was very particular in that it had to have a kind of magical air at the beginning. It's meant to be this very kind of crisp, aired, high up, beautiful sanatorium where it looks, it's kind of intriguingly odd. No way did we want it to look like it did originally. And that's why those kind of the pinks and the turquoise and the pistachio were very important to lift it above being just a very cream-walled, kind of pretty dirty old building.
On a budget level, it's amazing that you pulled this off with $40 million. What kind of creative compromises did you know you had to make from the beginning?
I suppose, having worked in theatre with absolutely nothing, I think a budget of $40 million is bloody amazing. So I was really chuffed. We were just really careful, but I think as we went through it, it became, you know, the main impetus was to make Beelitz look amazing. And when we got there, it was falling down. There's like holes everywhere. So we had to paint all those corridors, fix them up, shine the floors, do the gardens, make the awnings. So it was a kind of real labour of love trying to make it look like it was alive. But I suppose the compromises came down the line when suddenly we needed like 20 iron lungs, and they were meant to be all amazing and metal, and by that time they were cardboard tubes that we you know, or giant so a couple of them were plastic tubes, so we just were painting them up and hoping the room was so dark you wouldn't be able to see. So there was a lot. By the end we were really scrabbling.
We'll take things back and talk about the early location scout, because again, to create context for listeners, Vollmer's Institute is made up of several locations across Germany. Quote, Hohenzollern Castle seemed to have all the questions. It was isolated enough, but rather than looking initially frightening, gave the impression of being sort of a sanctuary from modern life that we'd all get to. The winding road through the trees was just so beautiful. Close quote. So I was wondering if you could talk about why some of the locations you picked compared to others, what were they offering you, and perhaps what were the creative conversations, not only between you and Gore, but the third person who I'm sure was very involved was the cinematographer, Bojan Bazeli, and how that location scout process unfolded.
Well, actually, I hate to make it sound too easy, but we were just, when we were looking at the original castles, Gore had, of course, looked at all of them in advance of any of us before me and Bojan ever joined the process. And he'd actually just looked up Disney castles, Germany. And of course, Hohenzollern comes up as like the, you know, one of the original inspirations for the Disney castle. And I think that was it, because it had that kind of amazing innocence, that kind of beauty, the isolation that we talked of. And literally, when you drive up to it, it was just extraordinary. It just did everything, the twirling, the kind of isolation. Yeah, that was probably the easiest decision we ever made. And it was quick.
I believe the reception nurse explained that visiting hours end at 3 p.m. precisely.
She did, but as I'm sure you're aware, Mr. Pembroke remains the CEO of a major financial institution. Under the circumstances, I was hoping you could make an exception.
If you would like to leave a note, I'd happily pass it along to Mr. Pembroke.
I understand the work you do here is important, and you're obviously a very busy man. But if you wouldn't mind finding time between administering aqua aerobics and jacuzzis to inform Mr. Pembroke he has a visitor with information of the utmost urgency to him personally, I'd be grateful. On the other hand, if you want me to write a note so you can slip it under his door with his breakfast tray on the off chance he notices it before his morning rub down, I'm afraid that's not going to cut it. You see, I just traveled 4,000 miles to get here. There's a red eye going back to New York tonight, and I intend Mr. Pembroke and I to be on it.
You plan to take Mr. Pembroke back to New York with you?
Is that a problem?
Of course, it is entirely up to Mr. Pembroke. He's a patient, not a prisoner.
As a production designer, you definitely understand the importance of wallpaper. When I think of A Cure for Wellness, I think of it as a movie about tiles. Because tiles, to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but they must have been one of the elements that you looked out for in regards to blending together all of these locations, whether they were similar and already existing or whether you were planting them artificially to make sure this felt like a one cohesive sanatorium when it was really so many locations across Germany.
Yeah, well, I think that was really important. We developed a really great way of making tiles, but definitely that was our cohesive, our backbone was the kind of tiled corridor. And every time we wanted to introduce a new set, whether we were walking into a swimming pool that was over in East Germany, we would make sure that I had a flattage of those same tiles in the same colours to kind of completely make you think that this was just a giant labyrinth that you could never, once you were in, you couldn't really get out. And that's part of what I was saying earlier, because we started filming on the top floor and we gradually moved our way down into the bath area. And then we started to introduce locations that felt like they were getting lower. The tanks in the wall of the swimming pool where they're exercising was built, but was to constantly suggest that we were kind of going further and further underground until he gets into the iron lung department.
Was this a creative process for you because it helped you make your way into darker territory? Or was it logistical in the sense of the lower floors needed more work?
No, it actually was a creative decision because the lower floors in Bielitz particularly were actually the most intact because the roof hadn't leaked onto them so much and they had lovely, lovely floor tiles. So no, it was definitely, you know, it's like the seven circles of hell. You're kind of descending. That's a kind of tried out trope of kind of literature where you're descending into this kind of nightmare. So that was an intellectual and creative decision.
I think A Cure for Wellness was an incredibly large learning curve. And I was quite good at architecture and I'm quite good at maths and everything. But the learning curve of how to work out the strength of a kind of tank or the strength of a piece of glass that has to be in front of that much water. You know, in that scene in the black room where all those amazing Olympic divers had trained for weeks and weeks and weeks to hold their breath. They're real people. They're real, like, German athletes.
You're talking about the room where all the bodies are just floating.
Yeah. So we've got all the bodies floating. They were real people. We built those tanks really early so that they could then train to be in them and hold their breath for over 2 minutes. They were extraordinary, those people. That's so they could do little judders and stuff like that. But of course, one of the massive problems with Bojan, you know, I had to work with him quite carefully, work out the lamination of the glass had to be so precise to hold that much bulk of weight of water, have it being hit, all sorts of things, have a person in it, plus not go green or wobbly when the camera looks through. But luckily I was in Germany. You know how amazing the engineering is there. So I literally spent about a month with these German engineers working out the glass, the lamination, the toughness and everything. And then also that giant cylindrical tank where he gets, you know, the kind of therapy with the eels, to work out that we could have that glass at the bottom and the water and everything. So my understanding of swimming pools and my ability to create one has expanded
quite a bit. Let me ask you about your relationship with set decorator Michael Standish. There's so much beautiful gothic iconography in the film, and anything from the bathtubs to the eels to the mounted stag heads, and you were talking about the medical machinery. All of that together makes the film feel so unique. And perhaps this goes back to your conversations with Gore, but I wonder how you and Michael aimed to create set design that was both haunting but also beautiful.
Oh, thank you for that. But Mike and I have worked together for 20 years, so we've done tons together. So he started with me on Topsy Turvy with Mike Lee, that operatic film. And genuinely, we just click. And I just think both of us together are very much involved in choosing artifacts and all the stuff that goes in it. And I've never met anyone like him. He can get such a deal. He can get anything for nothing. He's got the gift of the gab. So that's a kind of really, really great asset. But his diligence and understanding, and I think both of us have come from a very old bit of London where history's always around you, where you have an inherent understanding of antique and modern and how it works together, and you're not frightened to put things together, and you're not too meticulous about being accurate all the time. You're trying to create an overall image, and I think both of us have that confidence, having grown up in this kind of a very arts-laden ancient city.
Every time I rewatched the movie, I was still impressed by the amount of, speaking about Beelitz, how much was shot inside compared to, you know, anyone else would have given up and built any room. And I wonder, A, perhaps what did that offer you? But also, you know, I smiled because I went back about 2 years after you shot the movie, and I could walk through and see, depending on the state of the room, I was like, they must have shot here because this looks a lot cleaner. This looks newer and polished.
Oh, no, we tried to use as much Beelitz as possible. And in the end, we tried very hard only to build the corridors where, you know, he's lost in a maze and there's the deer. But I couldn't resist the kind of huge depth and expanse. And we couldn't have afforded to build that. I could get, you know, 12 East German painters working in there for 6 weeks, which, you know, made it look fine on camera. But no way could we have afforded to build all that. And I wouldn't have wanted to, because A, the building had a horrible history and a haunting kind of trauma thing, not only because of how it was a kind of military hospital in the war, but even after that, that everyone kept talking about there was a Russian serial killer who strangled women with stockings in the grounds. So it was like, it had this really weird feeling. And the more you went into the other building and other bits, the better it got. That kind of haunting spirit of bricks often shows somehow on camera.
Mr. Lockhart, my name is Heinrich Wollner. I'm the director of the sanitarium here.
How long have I been here?
3 days.
I need to call New York.
I took the liberty of informing your office, the accident, if that's your concern. They agreed with me that business can wait and your health cannot.
Again, I really wanted to uphold the kind of beauty in the sanatorium being very heightened. So when you got to things like the dentist's stuff, we were really lucky in that there just happened to be a really fantastic dental museum man who was in Berlin, and he helped us so much and had all this kind of, gave us so much advice. But again, we were very careful to pick it in very kind of beautiful, calm, serene colors. And I think it's the juxtaposition of the charming colors, the lines, the space, the nurses' outfits are kind of completely crisp. Everything seems perfect. And I think that's the juxtaposition of the kind of gentle perfection as to with when you've got machine, you know, drill digging you out. It just was really great.
A smaller budget sometimes prevents you from building sets full on, and you just have to be a little more clever about your set decorating. If you know you are not going to have a lot of resources, how do you try to manage them in regards to problem solving your way out of a situation using set decoration as opposed to building?
I would never rely on just set decoration. That's one of the biggest things. I mean, obviously, people in scenes like in the basement when there's, like, you know, all the laboratory stuff. But ultimately, it's the architecture or the walls, the floors, that give you all the information you need as a viewer. People understand what buildings mean and the status of the people who live there or the history. So I would always say use minimal set decoration and go for it in the bones of the buildings.
And it's proof, because the thing is, in regards to Bielitz, the outside patio doesn't exist, and yet you must have observed the strengths of the existing location and say architecturally this feels like it could be an extension of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would always use what buildings I could and any location I could use, because ultimately, like I said, there's something really odd, and I would say to most new production designers, there's something you cannot captivate with a set unless you've got tons of money, that ever recreates a building that's sagged, has got history, has got patina, has got even some ghosts in its spirit. Somehow they come alive.
My last question about the project, I kind of wanted to touch on your months of work inside Babelsberg Studio, where you built Vollmer's lair. How did your work on the sound stages compare to your location work? I don't know if you shot one before or after specifically.
We luckily shot Bielitz first because we had to catch the really good weather. And just financially, if you're on a big project like that, it gives us time to build the studio stuff while everyone's still working. We don't have to hire the studios in advance. But I think I prefer often working on location because I just think it already gives you a kind of history and a poetry of something that's gone before. And I think actors feel it. And this is why I'm known as someone very particular, even if you've gone to a stage build, that you have to believe it, that you're not cheating all the time, that the tiles feel like they're really dirty, the drawers actually do move out of the cupboards, the kind of you have to invest it with such a lot of effort to get it to feel real. But I think it's always worth it.
Is it true that part of a set in your soundstage completely burned down as you were shooting?
Yeah, it was actually the set that went on fire at the end. So in the lab bit. And yes, it kind of, the flames went up, and because it had been a really hot summer in Babelsberg. Luckily, we were out in one of the more distant, we weren't in the main bit. Imagine if we'd been in the really historical bit. We were actually out in a tram shed, which was like about on the site, but kind of remote. And yeah, the embers kept flying up into the roof and nobody really noticed. And then suddenly it all caught fire.
I hope you didn't have to rebuild it from scratch.
We did have to rebuild it. It was a bad omen that day because I'd also saw someone run over a pigeon. I thought it was going to be a bad day. It was like a Roman kind of warning.
You're talking about techniques of kind of maximizing budget. And before getting to the kind of projects you get to work on today, you started off on low budget films where a filmmaker's aspiration was usually twice as large as the budget would allow. So how do you try and manage your resources when you don't have a lot of budget? And you kind of have to use your imagination as far as working off the strengths of an existing location to try and build, if you're on location, just as little as possible.
Well, I think first of all, on a budget on films as a designer, you have to be very, very strong with the location department, and you have to really understand when you can build something and when you shouldn't build something and when you can build part of it within a location. So you have to be incredibly involved at the beginning. And lots of location managers are pretty egotistical in a good way, in that they think they always know exactly what it should be, where it should definitely be led by the production designer, who not only has a great understanding of the script, but has an understanding of the director's will and plus the overall way to manage resources, because as a designer, you're in charge of so many different departments. So you're very mindful of whether you need 10 men to lift carpets and things like that. I now understand the labor is going to take money off the screen for me. So I'm pretty quick to assess how much work things will take.
I mean, if we speak about shooting on location as well, I just wanted to, you know, kind of touch on your relationship with Europe, because we did speak about your master's in architecture at the Royal College of Art. And even though you're based, you know, out of the UK, what strikes me is that so much of your work has been shot across Europe. And just to name some examples, Denmark for Danish Girl, Sweden for Girl in the Spider's Web. So because you know so much about architecture and history, I wonder in what way do you think Europe has been the perfect training ground for you as a designer?
Europe is the perfect training ground in that you're so near everything. I mean, to get to Copenhagen takes, what, an hour and a half, you know, so quick. But the understanding of history piled on history, you don't even notice it as a European. It's very integral to your upbringing. And I think that really does help, again, with, I bang on about telling a story visually. But you understand very quickly by the kind of shape of a front door or a window or the chimneys, you understand not only the history, you understand where that probably is in terms of country, and you also understand the status of that character. And it's incredibly quick. And I think, obviously, my training in theatre was great, but it's all in a black box. And I felt, as I was doing more films, that I really needed to kind of engage with architecture much more. Although it's funny, I think the theatre helped me better. But I just think our understanding of architecture is kind of inbred, but has to be augmented with a kind of understanding and some kind of academic viewpoint on it, and that really beds it in.
Screenplay and director usually would be the other elements that make you decide to sign on to a project, but is a shooting location ever an element you consider whether you would like to accept a project or not, being able to explore a new land or new looks?
I do now, I'm old, but now because my kids have grown up. And this is a rare thing as a production designer to have had small kids when I was probably trying to really form a career. I had to be very careful about not being too far away from them, especially when they started school, which is really difficult, but having to be engaged with their lives all the time. I've worked a lot of places, but I would like to work somewhere like Japan, where the architecture is so different to ours. Anything kind of very Far East, or, you know, something very different would be exciting.
The last project I wanted to ask you about, I just wanted to touch on Cats, the film, because it's been a few years and I know that a lot of work went into the project regardless.
Oh my God, so much.
We're talking about real sets that are made for a digital studio. I know that you and Tom Hooper spent a lot of time discussing the ratio so that the sets didn't feel too overwhelming. So I wonder, what do you make of the fact that it didn't really connect with people as much as you hoped? Now that you can look back at it.
Well, the first thing is I hear that there is actually a cut of the film where all the cats have cat bottom holes. So I'd like to see that one, because I just think that would have been just the icing on the cake. I felt sad that it wasn't better, and I think it could have been better. I think it's a difficult project in the first place in that it's not a story. And I think that's where it came unstuck. It's a series of vignettes of these different cats that kind of come together in the original musical and, of course, the poems. And I think trying to kind of squeeze it into being a story rendered it not as attractive as it could have been. And I think just looking back, I think it needed much more careful, collaborative time with the musicians and Tom and everyone, and just a greater understanding of how he wanted a musical to come out, to have been more successful. But I still like that cut with the bum holes.
I will let you know the moment I get my hands on it. As we slowly begin to wrap up our conversation, I figured I could ask you a couple rapid-fire questions. The first thing that comes to mind.
Sure.
If someone has never seen anything you've done before, what is the first project you'd like them to see and why?
I would say probably The Danish Girl might represent me best, in that I used an awful lot of my theatrical experience, in that we had no money, but I managed to make it look incredibly real and believable, and kept it very beautiful in the artworks because I love colour, but managed to keep it a sensitive way to tell the story through art.
What's a project you wish more people asked you about?
That's a good one. It probably Cats, because everyone thinks I'll be upset. I'm not upset. I had a brilliant time and my teams were extraordinary and we made some brilliant sets and scenery. I'd like to talk about them more, but everyone kind of like, don't talk about Cats.
You know, what's so crazy about your resume Eve, is that some of your most impressive films, I'm sure, were the ones where you had the least amount of money to pull them off. So I wonder, what's one project for which you had had 10 times the amount of production design budget that was given to you?
I think the one that could have really done with some more money was The King's Speech for the street stuff and the exteriors, because we were suffering. It turned out okay, but that could have just done with a few big London sets, yeah.
I know you were born and raised in Camden Town, so as a fun question, if I only had one afternoon to visit an architecturally stunning place in London, where should I go and why?
I would say go to Camden Town. Go to the Roundhouse, because it is a big roundhouse which has had so many beginnings and ends and goes through massive changes all the time. Because it was where, when I was little, just before they closed it, it used to be where the trains moved. They drove into it and then they swizzled round on a roundabout so they could get out on a really tight corner on another railway track. And then as soon as it was closed, it was invaded by a circus company. And although it's very bad now and you can't have animals, I remember sitting on benches, looking at the ring, the sawdust ring, feeling so excited as a six-year-old. And underneath my set, I could see elephants running underneath me.
Here's my last question for you today. I just kind of want to ask you about your legacy. Today's last quote. Quote, when I rewatch the movies I've worked on, I don't see the actors. It's like they're dotted out. I only notice the sets, close quote. So what has been the biggest creative conversation with yourself in regards to all the great work you've produced, the work you're still looking to produce? And where am I finding you creatively as I talk to you today at this moment in your career?
I still think I constantly criticize and check myself. And in that way, I learn daily. And my biggest thing was to realize whatever you're putting on the screen, it will be there long after you're died. And everyone will see it and go, why didn't they put that lock in that escutcheon on that door in the King's Speech? But that's good. That's good for me to think like that, because I don't want to ever be complacent.
And there you have it, folks. Thank you to Eve for calling in to record this episode. To the team at WME for setting the conversation up. And of course, to Eric for taking care of the final mixing. Eve's newest film, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, opens in theaters March 22nd, with Kraven the Hunter also released on August 30th. If you're a fan of production design, feel free to check out our previous episodes with Oscar nominee Guy H. Diaz from Inception, as well as Oscar winners Barbara Ling from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and David and Sandy Wasco from La La Land. I'm Brando Benetton, and you've been listening to Soundstage Access.